On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we do trade deadline fallout. Tarek Skubal is a Dodger, made his debut last night. We review that and talk about what that move means for the future of the sport. We bring on Chris Cotillo of Mass Live to talk Red Sox. Adley Rutschman trade. Is Craig Breslow cool now? We'll do a little George Lombard Jr. conversation. Luis Arraez, debut in Philly, before I cry a little bit more about Adley Rutschman leaving the Baltimore Orioles, all that, and a whole lot more. Baseball Barbacast coming up. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world with a bigger 2026 turnaround than the Boston Red Sox. I'm Jake Mance. That's Jordan Schusterman. We were struggling for a while, but now we're back in the mix.
Yeah, it was ugly. It was ugly early. I don't know which one of us was closer to getting fired in April, but we have recovered. Neither of us were fired, thankfully. Sorry, Alex Cora. And we're going to talk a little bit more about the Red Sox with our pal Chris Cotillo coming up later. But before we get to Chris, one of our favorites, this guy pitched for the Dodgers last night, and I think we're going to talk about that. That's our opener.
Tarek Skubal, or as casual Dodger fans all across Southern California call him, Tarek Skubal, took the mound last night at Wrigley Field for the very first time as a Dodger, and for the very first time at all. Skubal had actually never pitched at Wrigley before last night. He took the rock and was pretty solid. Six innings, four hits, two earned, two walks, six Ks. Dansby Swanson took him deep, and the Cubs won the ball game to send the Dodgers to an L5. But the story was about Skubal. His velocity was up a half tick. The boos were swirling around the friendly confines. A banner attached to a plane up in the sky read something along the lines of, "The Dodgers are ruining baseball, or have ruined baseball." And then the Cubs proceeded to ruin the Dodgers. Jordan, we have really yet to sink our teeth into the Skubal of it all. There are a million threads to pull, a million roads to go down. Where would you like to begin?
Yeah, I mean, a few days removed, we've now seen him actually appear for the Dodgers. We've heard him speak. We've heard Scott Harris speak. I think we really do also need to dig into the Tigers element of this. When we did our special deadline reaction show, we barely even touched on the return. And the return is part of this conversation. It is part of why I do think it's an important part of the discourse. I do think this, like, who are these players? Why are fans even more perturbed by this being all, quote unquote, all it costs to get him? But also that there are smart people in the game that are like, oh my God, that is a lot to give up for 2 months of any player. So there's just some interesting stuff there. I think I actually do want to start with Scott Harris, because we did, talk about him as a main character, the decisions that he was going to have to make. When we had Jeff Passan on last Friday, we were contemplating what it was going to take for him to make this decision. What was that package going to have to look like? And also, why wouldn't it be the Dodgers? And so what it ending up as the Dodgers was, I think, not necessarily the surprise to a lot of us. However, the timing was interesting, right? The fact that this goes down almost two full days before the deadline, that got a lot of people's attention, because people said, oh, well, why didn't you just wait until the last minute and get the best possible offer? And I think if there was anything really strong to come out of Scott Harris's press conference, and he spoke for almost an hour and answered all the questions pretty directly, you could disagree or agree, was him refuting that notion. And I did think that that was interesting. So I did want to read some of the Scott Harris quotes. He said, quote, "There was a bidding war. There were a lot of organizations involved. There wasn't any need to stretch it any further. The organizations that were involved were extremely aggressive. They put in what I believe to be their max offers. Then they added to those offers and also got to a point of almost audible pain when they actually produced their best offers. They gave them to us and we pulled the trigger. Respectfully," and this is the real good pull quote here, "respectfully, the notion that we should have waited 24 or 48 hours later and extracted more value, that's garbage. That's not how these negotiations work." I think that this is, of course, Harris is going to defend his process here, but talking to people around the game, I do think that the truth is maybe slightly closer to what Harris is saying. I think there are some people that I've talked to that have been like, you probably could have taken it to Sunday and made these other teams, made the Dodgers sweat a little bit more. But waiting until the last few hours, especially as we saw how chaotic it can get at the end for a deal of this magnitude, I'm not surprised that they didn't do that. So from this, anything else that Harris said or this notion that kind of caught your attention?
I think it's worth trying to explain it a bit more. The Scooble deal was so separate from the other deadline happenings that it makes sense that it would be conducted separate from the other trades. Scooble was on the market as much as any player was going to be on the market. The package to get him was going to be sort of predetermined and pre-discussed. Every contending team that wanted to acquire Scooble had a meeting at some point last week where they got together and they talked about the packages that they would start with, the packages that they would go to, and the packages that they wouldn't go to. And so because of how predetermined it all was, I do understand what Scott Harris is saying. That being said, could have waited a little bit longer till Sunday, maybe, at least for the optics. And I also do believe that, like, if the Brewers say they're not going to go past that offer, like, well, the Brewers kind of stick to their process, famously. They're probably not going to go past that offer. And so I, when GMs speak after trades like this, I generally am like overwhelmed by the gobbledygook and the word salad. This was an example, a rare example of a GM saying something and explaining something to me that I actually felt like I learned something, right? Like, yes, I didn't think about this, Scott Harris. Thank you for explaining this to me in imbecile.
Well, it's that. And also, I do think, caveat being that there are Tigers fans that can rightfully be disappointed or frustrated. But I also think there was a lot of just straight candor here from Scott Harris. The two other main, and again, the response to that can not necessarily be positive, but I appreciate it because I don't think, I agree with what you're saying that oftentimes the response to these things is just GM speak and we're not hearing anything. But the other big takeaway here is Scott Harris being like, yeah, like, the reason we're here is because we were not good enough. I thought this was pretty strong. Quote, I think the ultimate blame on this, it lies with me. I should have built more depth. I should have found ways to keep players healthier. I should have found ways to find more buckets to clear more water in May so that we didn't have a 6-22 month. I promise you I've lost a lot of sleep thinking about it and coming up with concrete takeaways that I can use moving forward and make sure that this season doesn't happen again. I hate selling with every fiber in my body. I absolutely hate it. So he also just goes on and on basically being like, I wanted to give this team every chance to fight back into it. And they did to a degree. But when you also consider what happened in Scooble's last start, that catastrophic loss against the Orioles, and just the hole that they're in, how many teams are still ahead of them? Yes, you could say, hey, look, man, and they just won again last night in Seattle. They might still rally their way to it. When you look at the bigger picture, he said this is an opportunity to build a stronger foundation here. And even if that means not having Scooble for this run, he said the reason they didn't trade him over the offseason is because they thought they could win the World Series with him, with them here. He basically is admitting here, saying, I don't think we can win the World Series with him this year based on what our team has done this year. And I think that that is revealing. That is honest and also maybe kind of insulting to the team who still looks at the standings and thinks that they're in it. But I also kind of appreciate him being direct in that regard.
Yeah, if the team doesn't like it, they should have played better. Like if...
Okay.
I think that that is a narrative we see around deadline time. The teams that are sellers that are kind of in it being disrespected or feeling disrespected. And I think that there are some examples of that. The Tigers are under 500. They've played poorly. They blew a 7-0 lead to the Orioles over the weekend in Scooble's last start. They played 6-22 in May. I'm sorry, if you don't want your guy to trade Tarik Skubal, play better baseball. Like, it's that simple to me. And so I don't really hold a lot of sympathy in that regard. Let's pivot now to the Dodgers, if you don't mind. Mm-hmm. Because plays for them now.
He does, yeah. I mean, the part where he also said, yeah, we offered him an extension, and then Scott Boras was like, yeah, that extension was 4 years, $75 million after he won the Cy Young, so that wasn't a very competitive offer. I do that the premise, but I do think that, like, there's a whole conversation that we're just moving right past, which is the Tigers have no chance to keep him, so of course they have to do this. We just accept that as fact, we accept that as reality, and there's some truth to it, and there's some truth to the notion of just like, you are, all these teams can afford all these players. If they actually wanted to keep Tarek Skubal, they could give him a more competitive offer, whether that was an extension earlier in his career or in free agency. You're allowed to give him the biggest offer. No one is stopping you from doing that. But obviously, they had no intentions of doing so. So they trade him to the Dodgers, a team that it would surprise nobody, not just that they got him now, that if they try to keep Tarek, that they would try to keep Tarek Skubal long term, because they're one of the few teams that could, in theory, be in those conversations to give out one of the largest starting pitching contracts of all time. Let's just do the first, once it finally happened, we've been talking about the concept for so long. When it finally happened on Saturday night, what were the first reactions? Because we've had so many versions of these. The Dodgers have added so many of these players through so many different avenues, and each one gives a little bit of a different flavor, right? When they got Roki, it was a little bit different than when they got Tucker, and when they got Diaz, and when they got Glasnow, and all of these additions inspire a slightly different emotion, at least for me, as a neutral observer, someone who covers the game. I know fans, maybe it's more of a general, again, but I think each one is a little bit different. So where does this one kind of fall?
This was more of a, okay, what we thought made sense. It was sort of a confirmation of what we had already been talking about, that if the Dodgers wanted him, the Dodgers would have gotten him. In a weird way, it made me believe that the Dodgers were less confident in the roster they already had, that they felt like they needed to go and get Skubal. That was interesting. But at the end of the day, the fan in me does juggle this combination of, with intrigue. Because,
oh yeah.
Let me explain like the part of it, which is The fan experience of getting Skubal, of waking up on Sunday morning and being a Dodger fan and having Tarek Skubal on your team, that is a super cool feeling that is worth more than a win on a Tuesday in August, right? Like that is part of fandom, is the present under the deadline tree. And I wanted one of the other fan bases to have that experience.
Exactly.
Because Dodger fans, whatever the reasons, whatever the mechanisms, we can discuss, we can debate salary cap till the cows come home. Fact of the matter is, people wearing Dodger blue have had that experience again and again and again, to the point where it's almost more numbing. Like, cool, we got Skubal. Of course we did. Whereas if Skubal had ended up on the Brewers or the Rays or even the Braves, it would have felt more momentous. It would have had a larger magnitude to it all, where we were just so accepting of Skubal ending up on the Dodgers that once it actually happened, there was an element that was just kind of underwhelming to it. Like, yep, there we go. Got it. Next. Oh, Adley Rutschman's on the Red Sox. And then the intrigue part of it is it just ratchets up the stakes for October.
Yeah. And that's the part that, maybe, right, we have to recognize that this is maybe the perspective that is certainly changed for us, as opposed to people who are just following one team, which is most people that just care about their team and their team's chances. And the actual debate of how guaranteed the Dodgers are to win the World Series, we can have a version of that here in a second, because I do want to have a baseball conversation about where Tarek Skubal fits in, why they did feel like they needed to do this, what that rotation actually is, because it's easy to put all the fancy names on the graphic and be like, oh my God, this is absurd. But let's actually take a step and think about the status of all of these pitchers right now and what that really means. But back to that feeling of intrigue and entertainment, and even just the general idea of Dodgers ruining baseball, some of which has validity to it. We're not going to tell fans how to feel, but I do think that when we think about what does that really mean? Well, if you're saying, oh, now that they got Skubal, now they're going to lock them out, now they're going to, it's going to mean we're definitely going to miss games else here, I don't think this changes really anything meaningfully about how that whole process is going to go. I guess you could say that it will, because the point that I still do believe truly is that the optics, which is important, and the conversation about the league and the state of the league going into the lockout is going to depend. It maybe won't change the goals of either side, is going to depend on what happens in October. I really do think that how we're talking about it, because right now we're still just sitting on those two straight Dodgers World Series. And if they win a third, then congratulations to the owners. They get to continue pounding all of their messaging through the league that is, in fact, oftentimes directly acknowledging the Dodgers. If the Dodgers get upset during the postseason and one of these small market teams wins, it will be a slightly different thing that they're trying to say. Because right now, it's just focused on that is the team that has the chance to win. But for the intrigue, if we're just talking about us and like what we're looking forward to, the drama of this, every time the Dodgers have added someone, it adds to the level of, oh my goodness, what if they lose? What if you've stacked up this much talent and still fall short? And we saw it almost happen last year. And now the pressure is on, especially when other parts of the roster have gotten worse over the last 2 years. And I think that's maybe part of the reason why they feel like they needed to do this.
The heavier the roster, the louder and more impactful a potential fall would be. And I don't, like, I understand why certain fan bases are like, feel disenchanted. The A's or the Reds or even the Orioles fans, sure. If you're a Brewers fan and you feel like, yes, you swung and missed at another deadline, I get that. You're tuning in October. You're turning the TV on. Like, you are.
Yeah.
And you're going to live and die with it. And whether you win or you lose, like, yes, that will change how you think about it after the fact. But, like, I kind of refuse to believe that there is a significant portion of fan that took the Scooble to the Dodgers news and crumpled up their Phillies hat or crumpled up their Padres hat and actually threw it away and canceled their MLB TV subscription. They may feel an element of that. Like, you might feel that, but your actions are going to dictate how the league responds to you and how these teams, like, you're still a fan. If I'm mislabeling this, let me know. I'm sure you feel this way, but you're not quitting cold turkey like I did after the New York Jets butt fumble, where I haven't watched a game in, you know, 14 years. But yeah, I'm intrigued. I am intrigued by all of this. And the another thing I really want to hammer home is, like, when you talk to players, they're not resigned to the Dodgers winning. That is not how these people think. And maybe it is how some of these front offices think, where it's like, oh, we don't have a good of a shot, let's let it go. These players don't care if Tarek Skubal and Shohei Ohtani and Freddie Freeman, and if the Dodgers traded for PCA and Bobby Witt Jr. tomorrow, the players on the 29 other teams would still go out there, strap it on, and want to compete. And I think that, yeah, there's enough winning that the Dodgers can do where that, like, phrase, but I kind of wish that fans had a little bit more of that energy to it, where it's like, oh, you got Skubal, great, here we go, let's do this thing.
Yeah.
Now I again, I'm always hesitant to tell people how to feel, because, like, I do sympathize with the sense of disenchantment, but, like, I don't know, just no one else is rolling over, why should you?
Yeah, well, let's also just talk about why they would do this, and then we can finish on the return, because it also just speaks to just the Dodgers, one of the Dodgers' strengths, and why they'd be willing to do this when other teams wouldn't. But okay, so let's talk about that. Why did the Dodgers feel like they needed to do this? Clearly, they feel like they could. They paid a price that was much easier for them to stomach than any of these other teams, and that's part of the conversation as well. But this has not been the same Dodgers team we've watched each of the last 3 years. You know, 2 years ago, Mookie Betts had like a 140 OPS plus and was an impact hitter. And you had this year, Will Smith, who had, the last few years had been one of the best hitting catchers in baseball, has been injured and a total non-factor. Now Dalton Rushing is injured as well. They have presently the weakest catching group in the entire league, basically, right? Mookie Betts is still not hitting. Teoscar Hernandez is nowhere near the hitter that he was over the past few years. Kyle Tucker is making a bajillion dollars. He has a 722 OPS, right? So there is still, this is still a good team, but they are still looking at it as, okay, yeah, we're probably going to October, but getting a top seed is no guarantee. And we're still looking at this as, how can we increase our World Series odds? The bar for what the Dodgers are going to add is always going to be higher. It's because that is their sole focus, which is, as we, I think, have learned, not necessarily the focus of every other major league organization who are focused on building a good, sustainable team that is in the postseason often. The Dodgers are skipping past that part. They already know that they've established that floor. They can just focus on what is going to raise our chances of winning the World Series. And Tarek Skubal indisputably does that, not only because their offense is not nearly as good as it has been recently because of the injuries and because of some of these guys getting older, but also the pitching staff, which is, you put all the, as I mentioned, all the famous guys on the list. Who do we really feel like we know what we're getting? Not even just over the next 2 months, but once we get to October, whether it's due to injuries, whether it's due to me, it's Yamamoto, it's Skubal now. We'll just hope that his magical elbow surgery is not going to be pop up again this year as an issue. And then after that, because of the, whether it's the complete volatility of someone like Roki Sasaki, whether it's the complete volatility from a durability standpoint with someone like Glasnow and Snell, who didn't look great in his rehab outing last night, and then the total wild card that is Ohtani, let alone the fact that you have a breakout all-star in Robleski, who is now starting to show some cracks. Emmett Sheehan just got optioned. Now, did this team need Tarek Skubal more than other teams? Of course not. But if they were willing to go do it, there's a reason for it. And I do think that's worth considering as well.
Absolutely. Let's do the return.
Yeah. Well, actually, let's start with you. I mean, obviously, I follow these guys pretty closely. But like, your first gut instinct as someone who follows prospects and knows ball, but isn't necessarily has thought about Zaire Hope as often, or River Ryan as often as I have, yeah, or Brady Smith, like, what was your first instinct? I mean, you tweeted it when it happened. You said that doesn't feel like a lot, even knowing it's a rental. It feels like you thought it would be more. Why did you have that reaction?
I just don't really like Zaire Hope.
Oh, okay.
As a player, personally, like maybe he's a lovely guy, but
he is. He
is.
Yeah.
Dan. That makes me feel worse. I don't love the profile. I don't love the body. I'm not sure what he is defensively. I don't know what the hittability is. This is like, it's just not a player that gets me fired up, that I think is like, has a chance to be a perennial all-star. I'll eat crow if it happens. I hope I'm wrong. All that stuff. That's of the Dodgers' glut of outfielders. That's not the one I would have wanted. And I would have been willing to take a slightly less interesting pitcher than River Ryan in order to take a Quintero, in order to take a Sirota. DePaula was probably off the table. And so from my perspective, there is no player on this list where I feel great that they're going to contribute. Like, what is bankable here? The best case scenario for each of Hope and Ryan and Smith is high. Ryan has been injured quite a lot. People talking like he's Methuselah. Like, yes, he is older than Juan Soto. I understand that. But it's not as if this gentleman was fighting in World War I. Like, he's 28. He's young on Earth. Right? Let's relax. But the injuries concern me. And then Brady Smith is in high A. And like, who knows what that is for any high A pitcher. And so I think that there's nothing here that is bankable enough for me. And that is why I am underwhelmed by the return from a value perspective and what these guys are projected to be. I get why the Tigers did it. But I also think you need to understand that they weren't going to get a top 100 guy from one of these other teams, it feels like, right? Like, top 50, top 20 guy. Like, Theo Gillen was not on the table for the Rays. It does not seem like Luis Peña or Jesus Mate was on the table for the Brewers. And so, go ahead.
It sounds like Peña was. Mate, definitely not. And Peña, I would say, is pretty comparable to Hope, at least in terms of where you're looking at them on a top 100 list. And also similar in that there's like one guy ahead of him that you're obviously not getting, DePaula, Mate, right? So, but it also sounds like the Brewers were not willing to part with Logan Henderson, who would have been the River Ryan equivalent. And he's also someone who's already had more success in the majors. And if that's what the Detroit was prioritizing, then you can understand why they fell short.
Yeah. And so my meh-ness with it, that's why I'm curious for your thoughts on my layman's evaluation.
Yeah, no, I don't totally disagree with you. To me, it's I would phrase it a little bit different than bankable, because there's upsides and downsides to every prospect, but there's real risk involved in all of these guys. And so, which is what you're getting at, but I will just spin it in a more positive way. It's not going to make Tigers fans suddenly forget Tarek Skubal, but if I am looking at it through the lens of Detroit and what is the case for these guys, I'll just focus on Ryan and Hope, and then we'll take a break and bring in our friend Chris Cotillo. So just on Hope, I think digging into him more, especially over the last couple of days, because when I first saw it too, when I first saw, okay, he's the big one in the deal, I had a lot of the same thoughts as you. He has made more strides this season from a contact standpoint in Double A than I honestly thought he would be. That gives me more hope, all the puns intended. It's also nice to trade. To have someone literally named Hope as part of your prospect return is like kind of awesome.
Feels like a bit.
Like that. Yeah, it's kind of cheesy, but you know, it works. Congratulations to the Tigers, you know, headliner, people writing headlines about the Tigers. But he's made a real jump from a contact standpoint. Still someone that's going to swing and miss. What concerns me is that you alluded to it briefly. This is someone that was a plus runner in a really impactful way, was stealing a lot of bases. But he has bulked up in a real way, and he's not very tall. He's like 5'10", 5'11". So this is probably someone that's going to be in a corner outfield spot. And so, as we've seen with someone like Riley Green, who the Tigers fans are very familiar with, that can be an all-star. That can be an impactful hitter. But if he's in a corner and the defense isn't always awesome, there's a limit to really how much that guy can be like your best player. And that is honestly, right? Like if Zaire Hope is Riley Green, it's hard to say that's a failure. It's hard to say that's a bad thing. Riley Green's been a heck of a hitter in the major leagues.
Every time.
For sure. But it's like, is that going to be your best player? Let's say River Ryan, though. The reason why people in baseball don't necessarily care as much about River Ryan, how old River Ryan is, and yes, he's old in Juan Soto. The real fun one, born on the exact same day as Yamamoto. How about that? August 17th, 1998. They might as well be twins. He's older than Strider. He's older than Jose Soriano and Hunter Brown and Pallante and Brandon Fott and on and on and on. So yes. But I would say to the people making fun of how old he is, ask the question,
how old
why?
Are you?
What? How old are you? Is 28 actually that old? And then also ask the question why? Because I say that in a positive way and a negative way. The positive way is that this is an unbelievable story that River Ryan has even become this pitching prospect, because he spent 5 years at Division II UNC Pembroke as essentially a two-way player, was injured in high school, was injured in college, 11th round pick by the Padres, flipped to the Dodgers for Matt Beattie. Again, more injuries in pro ball. But man, once this guy got on the mound and was focusing on that full time, and certainly once he got in the Dodger system, the stuff was unbelievable, and this has been true this year too. If you hear, and even if you're a casual fan, by now you've heard the concept of stuff plus, stuff models that are grading the movement, the velocity of pitches compared to major league average. River Ryan has four pitches that are like way above major league average. The list of pitchers that are like that, I don't know how many other pitchers have that many pitches that grade out to that degree on stuff plus models. And we're just, it's 2026. This is what teams care about. And so we can say this guy's been hurt so much. He's never been able to put together a workload. But if you're chasing upside and you're chasing impact, this is someone that if he can stay on the field, I do think is going to be a real, real impact starting pitcher. That said, it's not hard to find smart people around baseball who would be like, why would I think he's going to be able to sustain that because of all the injuries? Forget the age, all the injuries, the lack of the workload, and he might just be a reliever. In which case, this is a failure of a return for the Tigers, because the whole premise is that you're getting someone that can replace Skubal in the rotation, maybe not right away, but in the short term. And so that's why there is a ton of riding on River Ryan. And for Brady Smith, you know, he's striking out a bunch of guys in A-ball, but it's impossible to know what you're getting from someone like that at that age. Now, I, in fact, I'm more concerned about a pitcher that is so young and far away from proving anything than someone that's old and has, you know, four plus big league pitches that I think River Ryan does have. So that's kind of where I'm at on this. That's why I am also underwhelmed on the whole, but I see where they are going with it.
What do you think River Ryan enjoyed most about playing for the Brooklyn Dodgers?
That's true. That's when he debuted, actually. And then he hasn't been back since. So he still has rookie eligibility. I will say, and I'll say this before we take a break, the funniest thing about River Ryan is that he still might be rookie eligible next year, depending on when he comes back from this hamstring injury. So if you think that these stupid debates over where he should be on the top 100 this year, oh my goodness, get ready for those conversations during the lockout. All right, on this, we're going to take a break here. If you have more Scoobal thoughts, let us know at baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. We're going to take a break. We return Chris Cotillo. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Baseball Barbecast, a return special guest. It's our pal Chris Cotillo, beat writer for Mass Live. He covers the Boston Red Sox as well as anybody, and he is also the host of one of the few baseball podcasts that Jake and I actually listen to, the Fenway Rundown with Sean McAdam. Chris Cotillo, welcome back to Baseball Barbecast.
It is always an honor. I know I pine for this moment at the All-Star game and saying that we haven't done a fully loaded pod with both of you in a long time, and here we are, washed as always.
Just like the Red Sox, we are fully loaded, as the club that you follow around and you think about and you write about was very active at the deadline, bringing in Adley Rutschman. But in my opinion, he is not the main character of the deadline. The main character of the deadline is cool guy Craig Breslow. And my question to you is, when did Craig Breslow become Dave Dombrowski?
When they went 31-32-8 over the last 40 games. I think that's when he made the flip to being uber aggressive and deciding to reward the team for doing what they have and all that type of stuff. I mean, it's been they needed a run like this to get into contention in this way, and they've obviously gotten it. So I think the Q rating with the fans has gone from like 0 to 95 over these few weeks. There's nothing that Craig Breslow has ever done wrong now. You know, look at all the guys they have. Andrew Monasterio is playing short every day. He traded for him. He's aggressive, all this stuff. So, but they, I think they just saw a window where the American League is not very good. They have momentum. Yeah. They wanted to reward the team. And, you know, very, very obvious to me, none of the guys they added were rentals. So that was important to them. When you talk about Rutschman, Eric Miller, Eli White, and Curtis Mead, who is hurt, those guys are all going to be here for the future. They obviously moved a lot and unquestionably traded a lot of very talented players a lot of different places, but they made bold decisions. They saw a market they could, you know, take advantage of, and you can, you know, think the Rutschman trade was an overpay. It probably is, but Dombrowski-esque for sure, and I think you look at you know, we've been talking about Chaim Bloom and Craig Breslow both not being David Dombrowski-like enough for the last 7-8 years. And now that has changed a little bit. And good for Breslow for doing it.
Yeah, so it is so interesting to me because we have opinions of executives as characters. And very rarely do we allow them to change our minds about them, where we have a set idea like, Craig Breslow is conservative about his team, and he's passive, and he's robotic, and he's calculating, et cetera, et cetera. Was there a moment in your mind between when he fired Alex Cora today where you could see his comportment change? Like, did his energy change? Was he talking differently? Did you see an aggressive, an uncharacteristically aggressive move like the Rutschman move coming down the pike?
Yeah, two things on that. Number one, I actually think with Breslow, they haven't necessarily won under him yet, but there have been those aggressive strikes. I mean, you look back to his first offseason was the full throttle. They didn't actually do that. And I think that that put him behind the eight ball in terms of approval rating because they made all these big promises and they didn't deliver. Lucas Giolito is a great guy, but he has main guy in your offseason, in which you trade Chris Sale and other things, is not full throttle for sure. Then the next offseason, you know, what worked against Craig Breslow is that he made some huge moves, but they were super spread apart. So it still felt like they did nothing. Like they made a huge blockbuster trade for Crochet in December, signed Bregman in late February, whatever it is, mid February. And that kind of started this line of really, really, really bold moves that he's made over time. So we'll start there with Crochet and Bregman. The Devers trade, you know, love it or hate it if you're a Red Sox fan, super bold move that he made. And then over the offseason, you know, kind of similar stuff, right? Ranger Suarez, kind of a big signing. Going out on a limb for Gray, going and getting Contreras and making, you know, the Durbin-Harrison trade. Right on to, you know, the bold move to fire Cora and then make these deals. So he has shown a willingness to kind of put himself out on a limb over and over and over again. Free agents, trades, they've bungled enough along the way that people forget that. Like, they thought they'd have Bregman for more than a year. They didn't know the Devers thing would turn into what it did. You know, all that stuff's been well documented. In terms of just the last few weeks, I think, you know, he's made some comments that I think have been more received, better received by the fans than ever before. You know, like, we're not here to win trades. We're here to make the team better. The other day was a really, really interesting one, a one that people really appreciated. And I think if you look at how much they gave up for Rutschman, they probably applied that same logic there. And I think that, you know, it is your just typical, like, winning cures everything. You know, we had on our site, talking to people in the game for a long time, McAdam had written in May, like, it's almost, you know, would be a shock to see Breslow have this job by the end of the year. Well, here you go, 32-8. You know, Connor Falefa and Gray and those guys were talking about there's going to be new players in here if we keep losing in mid-June. Well, 32-8. And so, you know, Breslow deserves a lot of credit for that because a lot of his moves have worked out. Tracy does. The players definitely, obviously, I mean, are going out and doing it every night, and they're working together as a whole. So, yeah, I think that the approval rating goes up because they're winning. That's the very long story long.
Hey, who's to say that IKF didn't he? I mean, there are new players in there, you know, good, that's true. New good players.
Yeah, that's true.
So I think when we first did our deadline reaction, we've talked about, and I think we're going to keep talking about this. I know you and Sean had this conversation, which is, once you get over the emotion tied to Baltimore moving on from Adley Rutschman and Breslow making these bold moves, there is an interesting conversation of just like, how good is Adley Rutschman? Who is this guy? What are we really expecting? He has this pedigree, first overall pick, 3-time All-Star. He's a name that people know. How good is he right now? That is also a complicated question right now because he is currently on the injured list and we don't know exactly when he's going to be back. But I actually don't want to focus on Adley here because what's more relevant and the reason we're even in this position is what you just referenced, 32-8. So my question is, how good are the Red Sox? Because I don't think that they're this good, but I also don't think that they were as bad as they were to start the year. I did pick this team to win the division, and I was looking pretty stupid for a few weeks there, and I still don't expect them to win the division. Thank you, Chris. I still don't expect them to win the division, but at least they've rallied to something where a lot of the things I was optimistic about have started to go well with the pitching and the defense. And I did love the Contreras signing, and that's gone as better or a trade, and that's gone as better than I ever would have hoped. So now that you've watched this team play as well as they've basically have since 2018, although did they even go 32-8 in 2018? Like, this is as good of a stretch as I could
have. So.
Okay. So 2018 had these ridiculous hot stretches, and that's the gold standard. But for this team, for even if they had a normal April to playing this well, would have been astonishing. So how good do you sense that they are? Yes, the American League is weak and the opportunity is there, but how much have they changed what you think about them as a ball club? And now, of course, they bring in these additions that bolster that. But even before that, how much have they really changed your mind?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there have been a couple of stretches during this prolonged streak where, you know, they've either gotten a good break here or there. They played the Mets and the Angels on a road trip. Both of those teams were kind of looked in the middle of July like they were ready to go home for the season when they played them. But then again, the Red Sox came home. And so, like, that's the devil's advocate. You could look at it and be like, okay, they just played the Mets. The Mets found ways to throw those three games away right before the break. And, you know, they played some bad teams. But they swept the Yankees at home 4 games. They swept the Rays at home, which was, I think, the most impressive of all this. Came out of the All-Star break. Doubleheader, swept them, beat them Saturday, beat them Sunday. The Rays didn't play particularly well, but still very talented team. They find ways to win. The Red Sox found ways to beat them. Then they, you know, obviously went to Dodger Stadium over this weekend and won all three games. And Sacramento, I think, is even the more impressive one of this last road trip because they played pretty badly for all 4 days. Four close games. They couldn't hit. They didn't like the batter's eye out there at whatever it's called, Park. And they ended up winning three out of four.
The Sut, dude. The Sut.
The Sut, sorry. The Health. they just like, you know, they've had all these things and they've just kind of kept it moving. It's not, you know, a 20-game stretch. Now it's a 40-game stretch when they've had a lot of injuries in the middle of that. They've done it all without Anthony and Crochet. I think that it's very obviously no team, you know, unless you're a true powerhouse, which probably, you know, they're not, is going to go 32-8 and be able to repeat that over and over and over again. What I do think is really interesting about this team and should really scare other teams in the playoffs, and I think is probably the biggest reason why Breslow went out and did what he did, is that the rotation is, by all accounts, elite, even without Crochet. And if that's still the case and everybody's healthy, it's going to be really, really scary to face in October, because you're going to have at the front end, if you have Crochet, you have one of the top five arms in the game. If not, you have Gray, who has had an awesome year, or you have Suarez, who has had a really good year and is a playoff horse. He's awesome in October. Or you have, you know, you guys know Peyton Tolley's energy. Imagine him starting a playoff game. He might, you know, float off the mound after each out. You have
throwing Bennett, 108.
Yeah, exactly. He does get hyped up. You have the complete opposite of him and Jake Bennett, who game seven of the World Series or a side session. He's the same guy, which is great in that way. He's been unbelievably good, better than anybody could imagine. Sandoval's come back and has been pretty good as a fifth guy. Bullpen Bayo is the greatest thing since sliced bread, as you've seen. So, I mean, you look at the just the guys they have, and I'm, you know, like Bayo, anything from Bayo or Sandoval or like Tanner Houck would be a bonus. But you figure out of Crochet, who just started throwing yesterday, Gray, Suarez, Bennett, and Tolley. If you need three guys to start, you know, or four guys to start in a series, you're going to get something really, really quality most of the time. And, you know, what wins in the postseason? Those types of starts and power, the power part of it, you know, they're going to need Contreras and Abreu and maybe if healthy, Rutschman and Meade to step up. But the bedrock and the of this team is starting pitching. The floor is so high. And I think now that they've kind of realized that and they're bunting like crazy, they're moving the runner along, they're being aggressive, just get on. I mean, they've had a lot of innings recently where they don't put the ball out of the infield and they score three runs just because they're putting pressure on the other team. And if you're the other team, I'm sure it feels like we're down 2-0 or 3-0 with any of these guys on the other side on the mound. You know, we saw it twice over the weekend in L.A. The Red Sox and Dodgers exchanged runs early, and then Tolley and Bennett were able to settle down really, really quickly. The Red Sox pull ahead. There was a couple punts in there. The Dodgers had poor Cole Irvin out there for like eight innings on Friday night.
They let him ride that game. They were like, go get him, sacrifice lamb.
Yeah, Dave Roberts, he actually DFA'd him on the mound as he was walking out. That was tough to see. Handed him the papers.
Hey, right, we're going to go ahead and send you out. You can keep walking, Cole. Just don't even shower. Yeah. Just go right to Oklahoma City.
Seriously, it was you could feel it. But I mean, credit to the Red Sox for, you know, knowing this pitching and defense model. It took them 2.5-3 months to really embrace what it actually took to win games, but since they've figured it out, it has been, you know, really aces, no pun intended. Good pun though.
So I nicely done. So you mentioned the starting pitcher being the bedrock, and I don't disagree, but and you alluded to it, but the bullpen is what stands out to me. And adding Eric Miller, this is a team with the lowest bullpen ERA, lowest bullpen whip, lowest bullpen walk rate, which with the bullpen – now, Eric Miller is going to – he's probably not going to help in that regard. He's walking like 15% of guys, but he's got really impressive stuff. I think that what people definitely want to know – now, listen, we can talk about Eric Miller and Durbin. We love Durbin. He's, you know, also a friend of the show. Jamai Jones and Eli, whatever. The two names we've kept referencing, we do need these updates on these guys, because for a while, what the casual throwaway references to Crochet and Anthony have meant has changed a lot over the last few months, right? Early on, it was like, oh, maybe they can come back and save us. And then it was like, well, why are we even rushing them back to a team that stinks? This is just depressing.
No, early on, are they even going to go on the IL? And then now they're both out 3-1. There's been a lot going on there, so.
Right. And
I was there that day in Baltimore before they fired Cora, where Anthony was like, yep, feeling good. Gonna be all right. Not too worried. And then Crochet was like, yeah, you know, just be a couple weeks. Here we are. And they haven't played.
Yeah. So we could recap the ups and downs of it, but let's forget all that. Let's just say where we're at now, because the Red Sox are surging. They think they can win the American League based on their moves and their comments. Now what is the update? You just referenced that they're throwing, and now it's not going to be as much of, okay, now they can come back and save them. It's more of, oh my goodness, how much better could this team be if these guys come back and are anything close to their peak? So just give us the updates on those two.
Yeah, I saw a couple people like in Red Sox Twitter space yesterday referencing, oh my God, they've won all these games. They went out and got us Rutschman and all these moves at the deadline. They bought and they were aggressive. And we're getting positive injury updates on Anthony and Crochet for the first time in months. And, you know, everything's coming up Red Sox in the stretch, right? I mean,
Ted Williams' frozen head is going to be unfrozen, and he'll be playing left field in September.
Well, that's crowded. Get Anthony, him, and Duran. So, you know, there's going to be a logjam roster crunch with Ted.
Does Duran play over the unfrozen Ted Williams? Who can say?
And at 120 years old, you never know what you're going to get. You know, the aging curve is, I don't know.
How old? He might be better than Duran.
we just talked about River Ryan. I mean, you think River Ryan's old?
They played together.
There's a lot to ask for
Ted Williams and River Ryan. Ball game.
Yeah. McAdam covered it all. I think that the not even here to defend himself. The updates this week were good though, because Anthony has been in this place where he literally couldn't swing a bat and make contact over and over and over and over again for months, and it was literally too painful with that weird ligament in his hand. They just had to let it rest. They let him rest down in Fort Myers, and now he's gone from soft toss and flips to overhand BP. You know, he's not facing velocity yet. That'll be the huge test, but he's continued running, staying in baseball shape. Throwing has not been an issue, the defensive part of it. So you figure once he gets against a trajectory and all that stuff, that could be pretty quick. I mean, this month for sure, maybe the early part of this month. And you talked about Duran, you know, and there's been a lot going on there as always. The bottom line is guy who's hit 200. He has two homers in the last couple of games. There has been some pop. Obviously, there's speed. The defense is there. But Anthony gives you a lot more upside, you know, as a real, you know, potent bat that you could play out there every day. And he obviously, I think, would be an upgrade when he slides in, even though he didn't play super well in April. With Crochet, I mean, this is a guy who I think the injury – the fact that he's still out is even more surprising almost than the Anthony one, just because it was shoulder inflammation. I mean, I think it was really the tour of the last time I saw both of you guys, not an all-star game, because he got hurt the first time in Baltimore. Last time he pitched. Then he had a setback in Cleveland when he threw his side, Jordan. So that one's on you. So I think that, you know, they've thought he'd be back a few times before now. He's now throwing out to 50 or 60 feet. As you guys know, with pitchers, it's, you know, going to be a long build. But what?
I was like, whoa, 60 feet? All right, now.
I mean, better than zero. But he's obviously, you know, when right, you saw what he did in the postseason last year. And
oh my God.
Even if he's a multi-inning reliever because he's not built up, I mean, that should be terrifying for teams too. So, the fact that both of these guys made tangible progress in the last 5 or 6 days is huge. I'm really glad the Red Sox didn't sell to the fan base. We don't need to make trade deadline moves. We get Crochet and Anthony at home, because that's something they've done in the past. You know, and then there's other guys too that are like, you know, what if Story gets on a heater here for a couple weeks when he comes back like he did last year? You know, I'm not saying that's going to happen, but it could. You know, what if Tanner Houck comes and is a good relief option? Like, they have a lot of talent on the IL still. Again, I'm glad for their sake that they didn't count on it and that they actually went out and made the moves they did. But now you have Rutschman, Miller, Eli White. We talk about that like it's a household name. and add Meade somewhere in the middle and between, you know, the long-term IL guys and the trade additions, because he's both now. But definitely they've given themselves so many options for reinforcements that even if a couple of these guys have setbacks, then, you know, there's going to be more on the way. So the roster, you know, at full strength on October 1st could be really, really good. And this is a roster that, again, do we mention 32-8 even without him?
How about that? Man. And it's also in contrast to the Yankees, who did kind of just gesture to the IL and go.
Yeah. Well,
maybe these guys come back.
Did Garcia homer again last night?
No, but he is a nice little addition. Chris, before we get out of here, we should ask about Marcelo Meyer just very quickly, because what a weird way for this to end. This is a guy that was drafted fourth overall, who is considered the top prospect in that draft, who really more than Anthony and Christian Campbell for a long while was seen as the face of this next wave of Boston position player talent. He is now a San Francisco Giant. How do you sum up the Marcelo Meyer Red Sox tenure?
You guys see, I had a bad tweet. I had a tweet that was very, very confusing that trying to clarify. I'll put it this way.
You've had way worse tweets, Chris. I actually thought that one people were a little bit too harsh on you for. I got to be honest.
Well, I think people thought that Marcelo Meyer was saying that he didn't have a long enough leash. He didn't say that. That was me just reiterating, you know, talking to people close to him. He's really excited to be traded to the Giants, but that doesn't mean he hates the Red Sox. That's right. I should have just, you know, tried to not be all, you know, journalistic and just be like, he's happy he's in San Francisco, and that doesn't mean he hates the Red Sox, which is really the point of it. But that's on me, my bad, and I've made that clear. I think that this is, you know, people are looking, I think, for, you know, was there this rift? Do the Red Sox have issues with him? Is he out in the north end of the seaport too much? Is his head screwed on right? I think those are all, you know, a little bit lazy in terms of narratives because there was a breakup. If you look at it, they have a ton of middle infield options. I'm not saying any of them are, you know, amazing or perfect moving forward. There's question marks with all of them, but you have Story for the next year. You have Connor Falefa coming back from the injured list. Monasterio's played great. They just acquired Meade, who's an option at second base, will be here for 4 years. Sogard and Siegler have both given you something. They're young guys who give you energy. Arias is one of the best prospects in baseball up the middle. I mean, that's what, 7 or 8 different guys, and a place where they suddenly have depth. Now it's on them to figure out, like, who are the tent poles at those positions for the next few years. But they saw an opportunity to move Meyer for Eric Miller. I think when you look at the whole Meyer experience, if I'm the Red Sox, I would have given him a longer leash. That was kind of the point of the tweet. The longer leash part was me thinking it wasn't that long. It was 114 games. Injuries are a huge part of this guy's story. Yeah, and I think when I look at the whole Marcelo Meyer picture here, there are every single guy basically who comes up to the majors gets time to figure out, like, okay, this is, you know, the injury you play through. This is how to be a big leaguer. This is what it takes. There are truly inevitable growing pains with everybody. And I think in a place like Boston with a prospect pedigree like that guy had, or Anthony, I think that the public, the fan base, and probably the media doesn't allow for that, those growing pains, as much as we should, because they're going to happen. And, you know, who's to say Meyer wasn't going to figure things out offensively and to hit the breaking ball and to maybe play through things here and there. Maybe a wake-up call of getting traded at, you know, 23, 24 years old is what it takes to make that happen in a new environment. So, you know, this is one I could see. I think, you know, in terms of the rest of 2026, which is Breslow's goal, even though Miller's controlled for a while, any team could use a really, you know, talented sixth, seventh inning arm, and they got that in Miller. He's going to have more of an impact on the rest of the year than Meyer did. I mean, I think he was probably going to AAA here once he was back from the IL. But I could see them regretting this long term because this is still an uber talented kid. The floor of the defense is amazing. He hit at every level. And I think that he's going to figure things out. And, but, you know, you look at the Red Sox in the past, they have not, you know, sold on guys when they still had value and faced the consequences of that. Durant a couple years ago being the best recent example. So, you know, I thought Keith Law did a really interesting, good job covering this of, I don't know why they're giving up on Meyer so soon. But, you know, at a certain point, they looked at it and said, it makes us better for the rest of 26. Miller seems like a fun character to cover. So I don't know if you guys know him personally, but he seems like a lot going on there.
He's built like a shed.
He is. I know. Yeah. They actually, they, if they ever, you know, what, like the, what's the big three tournament and, or that basketball thing that if they ever do that for pitching staffs and bullpens, the Red Sox are going to dominate because
they have some houses.
Tolley, Bennett, Chapman. Now this guy,
Crochet,
not Sonny Gray, but yeah, Crochet. You know, they have some. They
you bring Bayo off the bench. Bayo.
They're right. That's right. They love the extension, so I'm sure Eric Miller's extension jumps off the charts.
Chris Cotillo, thank you for the time. I would not be surprised if you're back here on Baseball Barbercast at some point in 2026. But for now, we encourage everyone to go check out the Fenway Rundown, read Chris's work. And yeah, thanks for doing this, man. This was fun.
Of course, guys. I'm glad that we are still doing trade deadlines 12 years after we broke in, not knowing what the hell we're doing. Now we know only a little bit, but it's still going.
Kill us. They can't kill youth. Yeah. We're still younger than River Ryan at heart. Chris, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks,
welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Enough about the Red Sox. There's something Yankees related that we got to talk about. MLB debut last night for Yankees top prospect George Lombard Jr., the son of George Lombard, because that's how names work. Former big leaguer, current coach for the Detroit Tigers. Dad got the day off. AJ Hinch said, "We traded Scooble. We're not trying. Season's over. Go see your kid make his big league debut." So he did. And George Jr. went yard in his second at bat, turned a sick double play. It was quite a debut for the next great hope at shortstop to fill the mammoth shoes of one Mr. Derek Jeter. To add to the coolness of this all, George's younger brother, Jacob, who was a first-round pick earlier this year, 14th overall to the Marlins, made his pro debut last night in low A. His parents, the Lombards, were planning on going to that game. They quickly changed course and flew up to New York instead. But Jacob homered in low A for the Jupiter Hammerheads. So two dongs on the same night for the Lombard family.
Very similar home runs aesthetically, like both on breaking balls, both against the Cardinals, the Palm Beach Cardinals and the St. Louis Cardinals. So Jacob is this whole other conversation, but let's focus on George Jr. You were there pregame, I believe, to kind of take in the first introductions for this guy. And I mean, there's a lot of different things with this. Of course, you mentioned Jeter, but I think Volpe is the one a lot of people are thinking about, especially with him going back to AAA. So how did Aaron Boone talk about that? And what is your sense, especially having experienced a lot of the Volpe hype and opposite of hype over the last few years?
I mean, George Jr. coming up as Volpe and Dominguez go down speaks for itself. Prospects are volatile. They are not sure things. Your hope is only as real as the next great hope. And while none of that is George Jr.'s fault and should not be held against him, the ghost of Anthony Volpe lingered over the pregame proceedings yesterday. I did not stay for the game. I would imagine that when George Jr. homered, the Volpe of it all disintegrated from the Yankees' minds and from the fans' minds and whatever. But before the game, like, it was really difficult to not think about the way the Yankees talked about Volpe 3 years ago. I was there for Volpe's debut. I went back and looked at some of the quotes that Boone had around that time, and they sound pretty similar to some of the quotes he has this time about George Lombard Jr. Boone yesterday, quote, "What an outstanding member of our organization, someone that represents our organization." Boone in 2023, when Volpe was added to the roster at the end of spring training. A big part of this quote is the reputation he's earned within our organization. They both got rave reviews for their off the field mentality and their makeup and all of this stuff. Right. And so it's like, yes, you can look at with a player that Volpe was and say, well, you know, Lombard's going to be different and maybe he is going to be different. And I think that we as an industry and you and I, as people that talk about the game, need to think hard about what went wrong here with Volpe. Like, why did this go so sideways? Because I feel pretty strongly that this is over now, right? Like,
yeah,
Anthony Volpe being a contributing member of the New York Yankees, that ship has sailed. Aaron Boone can say that we still have high hopes for this guy and his career, yada, yada, yada. But like, I mean, the writing's on the wall. You can only believe actions, and the action was optioning his tush back to AAA. The fact that Volpe still had a locker in the Yankees clubhouse yesterday was pretty striking and shocking and fascinating to me. This happened the first time he was optioned. At that point, though, like, even when he got sent down, plan A for the New York Yankees was that he would come back up at some point and he would figure it out and he would be helpful. Plan A for the New York Yankees no longer involves Anthony Volpe. It does involve, however, the boxes of cleats and the shirts and the batting gloves that are still in his locker. I am really interested as to why that's the case. But yeah, like, it was hard to not feel bummed that that story didn't turn out the way it could have and it should have, and also be excited for George Jr., who is not involved in any of that at all.
Yeah, and I guess we'll see if... I mean, they just sent him down yesterday. Yes, they do. They normally do clear out the lockers pretty quickly. So it'll be interesting. Yeah.
It happened last time. Luis Gil, his locker was... There ain't no locker for the rookie of the year up there. Like, Dominguez didn't have a locker yesterday. He was sent down with Volpe. Like...
Okay.
I just say.
Yeah, but also to your point, like, I just don't know what the path back to him being on the team is, because if this is them pressing the button and saying, all right, go time with George Jr., he's going to be the shortstop, and he showed why there's reasons to be excited. Frankly, in the same way that Anthony Volpe did show reasons to be excited earlier in his career, the problem is that he was given, and this is what Yankees fans who have been exasperated by this, he was given an insane amount of playing time for someone that was performing at that low of a level. And yes, you could say, well, this is what Boone constantly said. He's still providing good shortstop defense, and there was some still power and speed which in there. But historically, you can't find players that got this many plate appearances and were reaching base this infrequently, right? Like, it is that is why people were kind of so tired of it, and why I think the Yankees finally moved on. The last thing I would just say about Volpe, and as we compare him and George Jr., because that is going to keep happening, as far as just like almost the skepticism of like, why do I think this one is going to go better? To me, what's so interesting is that Volpe's minor league track record was essentially impeccable. He was unbelievable especially once it got past COVID. From 2021, his numbers destroy George Lombard Jr.'s numbers. They just blow them out of the water. Whereas George it was more of a steady progression to where this year the production really started to get all together and the tools were starting to translate. His numbers last year and the year before were not anything special in the way that Volpe was just like, oh my God, I can't look at this. He's getting 30 homers and 50 steals and he's hitting 320. It was, and so once he got to the majors, it's like, what else are you going to say? He did everything you could possibly ask him to do. And then for whatever reasons that we'll continue to kind of think about, it just didn't translate. Whereas George is on a much more exciting trajectory, even if there are some holes in his profile as well.
I'm going to take a shot at comparing and contrasting the two. And I'm going to use a little vignette to try and do that. Yesterday, during the George Lombard press conference, Brennan Cuddy of The Athletic asked what number he'd be wearing and why. There's this very weird thing about numerology around Yankee land that I find both interesting and exhausting. But Lombard was like, I'm going to wear 96. And Cuddy was like, why? And he was like, that's what was in my locker. And Cuddy was like, you know, that's the last year the Yankees, like when the Yankees dynasty started in the 90s. And Lombard's like, yeah, sure. Whereas for Volpe, do you remember there was the whole thing about him trying to get number 11 and like Gardner gave it up? And it was like, was a crowning. There was this destiny that was assigned. He's a Yankees fan. He's from the city.
Yeah.
He grew up in New Jersey. Like, this is his dream. He's got Jeter on the poster in his bedroom. Like, the weight of that, I think, got to Volpe. I really do think it did. He wanted this so bad. And what happens sometimes to players is that once they care too much, it can affect what's going on between the ears. And then they make adjustments and they get away from their game and they play passive. I think we're seeing something very different but similar with Gunnar Henderson at the big leagues this year, where he's struggling to, not because he grew up an Orioles fan in Alabama, but because like he struggled to get going. He made some changes. He's not getting comfortable. He starts second guessing his own ability. And then now I think Gunnar's going to break out of it and he's not Anthony Volpe. I'm just bringing up another way that this dynamic can happen. But like for Volpe, that is my working theory, that the size of it all, the weight of it all, the expectations, he was crowned. He was given 11, like, the Jeterification of it. None of that matters at all to George Lombard Jr. He's from Miami. He followed his dad around the big leagues. I'm sure that there is something about being the Yankees shortstop that is like different than being the Reds third baseman. But like, I think that being removed from how much it matters can be helpful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I'm interested in like, the pros and cons of the fact that he's so comfortable, he's the son of a big leaguer, that comes with its own pressures and expectations. But he seems to be using that in, he's leveraging that privilege in a way of comfort as opposed to, it seems like it's just like, yeah, yes, I, when you're a son of a big leaguer and you start to become this top prospect, there is expectations that you're going to become a good player. And he didn't know he was going to be drafted by the Yankees and become the Yankee shortstop. But it feels like that just gives him some confidence as opposed to like, oh man, I better live up to the fact that my dad was a big leaguer too and all these, and now I'm the Yankee shortstop. So we'll see. Well, we're obviously, because anyone with the Yankees like this, like we're going to learn about this kid pretty quickly, both on and off the field.
Yeah.
And so I'm looking forward to seeing just how this goes.
Let's go around the league pretty quickly before we get on out of here. Day one of the Philadelphia Phillies' new-look roster went incredibly well. How about that? Luis Arraez hitting fourth, playing second. Two knocks, gets some RBIs, fires up the crowd. Exactly what the Phillies needed. He did not hit a baseball that hard, but that's kind of the bit.
Didn't need to.
It was like, it was an advertisement. It was like a trailer. It was like, hey, here's what you can expect with Luis Arraez.
Yeah. My favorite part, and Mike Petriello tweeted about this, it is great that we got Schwarber leadoff, Arraez cleanup. Like, if you had told, with a team managed by Don Mattingly, like, if you had Don Mattingly be like, hey, Don Mattingly, this is how this guy is, this is how this guy is, you're going to be managing the big leagues in 2026, and guess which one's hitting leadoff and which one's batting cleanup.
I also love like the very first pitch of the game was a tailing line drive into right field that Bryce Harper tracked down. The right field experiment went well. Go ahead.
Just tracked down. Yeah, he had to range over, but Lizardo pointed at him as if he had, like, you know, made one of the best plays of the year.
best plays he's made out there since 2021.
Correct. That is definitely correct.
The funny thing is, Billy, Bryce Harper has never played outfield for a competitive Phillies team, which is really difficult to wrap your brain around.
That is really weird. All right. Well, pressure's on, man. Let's see how many five-star catches you can rattle off over the next few months. A couple other topics before we say goodbye. You know what? Let's the Jacob DeGrom Braves thing. Let's see what happens with the Braves. Braves are winning. The Braves are an interesting character now for the rest of the season. Can they stay ahead of the Dodgers, ahead of the Brewers? Can they get the bye? We'll see. their deadline is something that their fans are very upset about. Jacob DeGrom is maybe a big part of that. Anthopoulos was pretty snippy with reporters about that. But
he was a I'll do this for my bet. AA was a schmuck yesterday answering a question about the deadline, saying he didn't understand the question and then just proceeded to answer the question. It was a level of like disrespect that I thought was unbecoming and disappointing from him. And I'm not, he was clearly frustrated that Jacob DeGrom said no. And that the Braves deadline didn't necessarily go the way they wanted it to. Last deadline thought before we get out of here, I want to talk about Adley Rutschman, Jordan. Adley Rutschman on the Boston Red Sox now. And I just want to take off my baseball professional hat and put on my Orioles, appreciator hat.
You felt like you were born into it.
But like, that is kind of how I've reckoned with this. And there was a sort of catharsis to it. And I never want to lose my fandom and passion for the sport. But my fandom and my passion for the Baltimore Orioles feels pretty definitively severed. It is a franchise that I will always think more about and care more about because the people that are around me care and think about it. I live close to there and all that. Adley Rutschman was really the last remaining link for me personally to a different version of how I viewed the sport. Where when he was drafted, I wanted the Orioles to win. And then I wanted to do like a good job having a nice time being around baseball and making content. That's not my life anymore. And with him off the Orioles, I feel as if a part of me can kind of let that go. Is that a bummer? Absolutely. Do I wish they'd won a World Series before I was, gave this up? 100%. Do I wish they'd won a playoff game? Yes, as well. I thought that Michael Elias's quotes yesterday on the broadcast were inadequate and embarrassing, and 8 years with no playoff victories deserves a tough look and all that stuff. But again, I'm just talking about this from a personal level. I feel a sense of weight off my shoulders. And maybe that's sad, but what have the Orioles done to keep me invested as a fan?
Sure.
When I have, you know what I mean?
That is super, super, super fair. And, Andy Azokar, sorry, man. When Andy Azokar is winning MVPs, Jake's just going to be saluting from a distance. Be like, man, nice.
Happy for you.
All right. Thank you to Andrew Hartz and Carter Singh for producing. Thank you to Chris Cotillo for joining us. We will be back on Friday with more Baseball BarbieCast. Talk to you all then. Bye.